This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ken Bernstein joins me. He blogs at dailycoast.com as Teacher Ken, a public school teacher. Ken, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Coy.
So you wrote recently in your reflections about 9/11 after watching some of the new documentaries. Share some of these thoughts with us.
Well, perhaps the most powerful moment in reflection, I'm sorry if I break up, is to watch a batch of New York firemen walking towards the buildings, carrying their equipment, looking up when one building has already collapsed and not even hesitating to go into the second building where they all died. And even in the clip that you dealt with, the police trying to move people back out of danger zones, but staying in the danger zones themselves, because it was the only way they could move other people out. Or to hear about, by the time they put out the emergency call for all off-duty firemen to come in, most of the off-duty firemen had already reported on the road. So there's a need, and people respond. I grew up in and around New York. I lost friends in the building. I was not there. It could have been a lot worse for us because one of my wife's sisters is married to an FBI agent who was stationed in New York at that time, responded to the scene, and when the towers came down, we lost cell phone contact, and we didn't hear from him till almost 4 o'clock. We thought we had lost him. So when I think about 9/11, besides the loss of life, I realized that a large chunk of that loss of life were people who responded to help other people. As you saw in the piece I wrote about it, 23 NYPD cops, 37 Port Authority cops, 343 firefighters and EMTs.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. He blogs as Teacher Ken at Daily Coast, one of the more popular and recognized national bloggers. Wrote an essay recently about courage on 9/11, and it really is striking, Ken, because I agree with you. I was watching one of these newer documentaries recently, and they had this footage of just these public servants. I mean, that's really what they are. They serve the public, and they were walking, rushing into these buildings to save lives, knowing that it was likely they weren't going to come out, but they rushed in anyway. And as you point out, you had all of these men and women who were off the clock, and they rushed in to help as well.
Yep. And in the aftermath, if you think of all the iron workers who responded to try to first save if anybody was left and rescue the remains, in a situation that we learned much later was much more hazardous than people at the time were being told, although I think many of those who worked there knew it, but felt it was something they had to do. And this is not in any way, as I point out in my article, to diminish the courage of those who serve in the military. After all, there were many who, feeling this as an attack on our country, volunteered to serve, and many of them lost their lives or came back very, very badly damaged. I am not denying that. But the very thought, myself having once been in a fire, of going into a fire, knowing the risk that it represents because there are other people you're trying to save, is to me something incredible. Or friends who are policemen who have told me that the worst call you can get is not a policeman under fire, or a bank robbery in progress, although I knew a policeman who died in such a circumstance, is responding to a domestic disturbance because you never know what you're going to get, yet you have to go. That's courage.
Yeah. We're talking with Ken Bernstein. He blogs as Teacher Ken. You can Google Teacher Ken online and find his work at dailycoast.com and elsewhere. Ken, let me ask you this, because we saw, as you are illustrating and really you know, speaking very candidly from the heart here about the courage that we witnessed on 9/11 and the courage we've seen since on the part of, young men and women who've served this country. I'd like to ask you about the courage in the political arena, and I mean on both sides. You know, left, right, up, down, I've never really cared. Just get the job done and make the country a better place to live and a better place for our kids. What does speak to this whole issue, this courage among elected leaders since 9/11? Have they dropped that ball? I mean, have they followed the example that other public servants set on that day?
It's a mixed bag. There have been people who will demagogue any issue for political advantage. That does not necessarily belong to people of one party. There are people who want to play gotcha with anything you say to distort it. I see it on both sides of the political spectrum. In fairness to your listeners, Daily Coast is a Democratic blog, and my own politics tend to be fairly far to the left, and people should bear that in mind as they are listening. But when you see something like the demonization of Max Cleland in the election of 2002, a man who won a Silver Star and lost three limbs, serving in the United States Senate, having his opponent, who never served in the military, run an ad that morphed his face into Osama bin Laden, it is somewhat understandable why some politicians operated out of fear, because the issue was being demagogued. On the other hand, we have had a long history of some politicians who lacked the courage of doing what was right if they feared it might cost them an election or control of the Congress or something else. There have always been people of both parties who have shown courage on issues. If you go back, the famous story of Lyndon Johnson on the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that when it passed the Senate, he turned to one of his aides, I believe, Bill Moyers, and said that basically has probably cost us the South for a generation. But Johnson, having seen poverty and having seen racism as a young teacher in the Rio Grande Valley, felt that it was the right thing to do, so he did it. And I might remind people that he did it with the votes of some very courageous Republicans, like Everett Dirksen. As far as where it is today, you will find people who will speak out on issues that they think matter, issues of courage. But you also have to recognize that for people in the House or in the Senate have to operate in a collegial environment, and they sometimes are worried about that if they speak too broadly, it will be interpreted as an attack on the colleagues with whom they must work to accomplish to get things done. There is a reluctance in some cases to stray too far from what the caucus agrees, and that's true on both sides of the aisle.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. He blogs as Teacher Ken. You can Google Teacher Ken and find his work. Very well-known national blogger at dailycoast.com. So there seems to be there's some courage, and I would say, you know, I think in Virginia we can be proud of Senator Webb for the courage that he's taken originally on the new GI Bill, which was going nowhere for decades, and until he got in there and said, it's time, we need a new GI Bill for our veterans. And now he's displaying what I think is some real courage on a real third rail issue that a lot of people have been afraid to touch, and that's overhauling the nation's justice system and really asking some tough questions. Do we want to be locking up small-time drug offenders and even small-time drug dealers that are filling the jails for, you know, marijuana charges and not much more than that.
Let me talk about Jim Webb briefly. As you know, I was very active in his campaign. I was on the edge of the circle that kind of persuaded him to run. He sometimes irritates some of his supporters because he says exactly what he thinks. If you want to see an example of Jim Webb's courage, it was during that campaign when, as you remember, in 2006, we had a referendum for a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, even though it probably was not necessary under Virginia law. Since he was not yet in the Senate, there was no reason for Jim to have to take a position on it. He took a position on it. He came out against it, and he phrased it the way he phrases lots of things, in terms of his libertarian streak. He said, there are three things that the government needs a damn good reason to come across my doorstep: how I pray, who I sleep with, and my guns. And he came out against that particular thing. There are people who have done similar things in the Republican Party. Think of George Ryan, the governor of Illinois, who knew he was going to be going to prison for his own corruption, being convinced of the fact that there had been so many errors in the death penalty cases in Illinois that on his way out, he took every remaining person condemned to death in Illinois and converted their sentence to life without parole, just in case there had been a mistake, so that we would not have a circumstance of finding out afterwards somebody was executed for a crime they didn't commit.
We're talking with Teacher Ken Bernstein. Ken, can you stay with us through the news break?
No problem.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes. We're going to take a break here for local news and get a weather update. We'll touch base with Rick Daniels out at Brown Toyota, and we will continue our conversation with Ken Bernstein. Let's rejoin our conversation with Ken Bernstein. He blogs at dailycoast.com, a nationally recognized blogger. Blogs as Teacher Ken, a public school teacher. Ken, you still with us?
Definitely, Coy.
Thanks for staying on the line. I appreciate it. I wanted to get your thoughts about the upcoming election now, and along the lines of what we've been talking about the courage. And you and I both know each other, and I think we are alike in that we applaud somebody who wants to get involved in politics, wants to be a leader, and has the courage to stand on their own and not necessarily follow the party line, but to stand up for what they believe is right for their community and right for America, and isn't always quick to demonize somebody just because they disagree with them. I think that's what has gotten us in so much trouble as of late, is this sort of knee-jerk reaction to demonize people who just disagree with us on politics. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think we have what will turn out to be a measure of whether you can do that right here in Virginia. The closest House race in the last cycle was Tom Perriello defeating longtime incumbent Virgil Goode in a district that is Republican. There's no doubt about that. Now Perriello is again like he was the last time. He's trailing in the polls, although this time he's not trailing as badly in money. But you are talking about somebody who has taken votes sometimes with his president, sometimes against his president, always saying what he thinks, why he is doing the vote. When other people started shutting down their town halls in August of 2007 because some of the Democrats were facing angry people from the Tea Party movement, Tom just continued to have his, and I think he held 20 town hall meetings that congressional break as much as anybody else. So somebody who does that is demonstrating courage, and you will have to see whether he is rewarded for that or not by the voters of his district. Now, they may respect him for that and disagree with him enough on politics that they will vote against him. You won't know that until you can analyze the after result. But there is an example of somebody, and I should disclose that Tom is a friend. I met him through Cree Deeds, and I greatly admired him. I admired some of the work he did before he got involved when he was doing human rights work in Africa. And I admire the fact that he lives his faith, that he tithes 10% of the volunteer hours that he gets for his campaign to doing community service, such as building houses for Habitat for Humanity or stocking food banks. There are people who, there's always a balance between I'm going to do exactly what I think is right and then listening to what is possible to be able to get things accomplished. You can have people on either the extreme left or the extreme right that it's my way, or even though you're close to me, I'll take you down because you don't agree with me 100%. When there is a place for people on the fringes to push the dialogue, it serves a purpose in American government. But when we swing too far one way or the other, we start losing a lot of people who are less interested in the ideology that one is pushing than they are in how this is going to affect their lives. And right now, for a large number of people, the only issue is their own economic insecurity.
So
the impact of that, the party in power is usually the one that suffers. My own guess right now is I'm seeing a little bit of a change in the dynamic. You see that reflected by John Boehner, although he's been slapped down by some of the people in the party, saying over the weekend that he wouldn't stop the tax breaks for the 97% of Americans for keeping the other 3%, but now apparently he's backed off of that.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. He blogs as Teacher Ken. Could you talk a little bit about this real nativism that we've seen in politics? And, of course, nativism has a long history in American politics. One particular type of Christianity attacking another, the Baptists against the Protestants or against the Anglicans and here in Virginia, and then, against the Irish. And, it's always been there, but we seem to have a particularly vitriolic brand of nativism that is not only alive and well in American politics today, but seems to be gaining ground.
I don't know that it's gaining ground. I think part of what has happened is it's gotten a lot more attention than its numbers ever warranted, because when it started in a big way last summer, it was August. August is when Congress is not in session. August is when there's not much happening on Capitol Hill, so the national news media that tends to cover political stories was looking for a story. That kind of elevated it to more than it was. Now, it is true that in some places in the country, the people most likely to turn out in the base for the Republican Party in a primary tend to tilt very strongly in one direction on a certain number of issues, and that can lead to upsets of conventional figures. You just saw that up in Alaska with Lisa Murkowski. But before one gets into that too much, remember Lisa Murkowski bears her father's name. Her father was somewhat hated by the end of his term, and there is no love lost between Sarah Palin and the Murkowskis. So there were some personal elements that got involved in that issue as well. We will have a better sense tonight of how far this goes by looking at the Delaware Republican Senate primary. Mike Castle is unbeatable as the Republican nominee before what has just happened which is a woman who's run twice before, Christine O'Donnell, who has started attacking him, started rumors about whether or not he's gay or not, to the point that Castle has now started a robocall today on Election Day from her former campaign manager saying she's not a true conservative, this being a woman who was fired from her position as campaign manager. All this does is irritate some people, but it does raise the temperature and the level of anger. There will always be people, we're not going to live in a perfect society. There are going to be people who are racist. Spike Lee notwithstanding, some of them are going to be black. We have black racists. We have white racists. We have Asian racists. We have people who just don't like anybody who is not like them. Their influence that they've had has been diminished, rightly so, over time. But it has never totally gone away. And it is to be expected that you will see, in times of economic uncertainty, a desire to find somebody to blame, and the more that somebody is perceived as other, the easier it is to blame them. And politicians and political consultants take advantage of that fact.
We're talking with Ken Bernstein. Ken, before we let you go, your blog post today is headlined, 0.1% has 11% of the income. We often hear in this country about the widening gap, the disappearance of the middle class, the widening gap between the very wealthy and the very poor, and the rising numbers of working poor. I guess what we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years is those numbers in the middle class sort of peeling off and becoming part of the working poor. And again, this is the big issue going into this election this year, is the economy.
It is. It's interesting that on the post that I did, somebody came up with some statistics from the Tax Foundation, which is not exactly liberal. They say there are 141 million tax returns filed in 2007. The top 0.1% would be 141,000 tax returns, and that was 11.93%. To make it into that, you needed an income of over $2 million, whereas in 2001, to make it into that percentage, you needed $1.3 million. That is, the income level of people at the top 0.1% went up 62%. In 6 years. The top 100th of 1%, the 13,000 figure of families that was being quoted, believe it or not, has 6% of the total income in the country. There are people who are saying that we are moving in the direction of a place like Brazil or Russia with a small group of very wealthy people at the top and a whole lot of other people struggling. It is an issue. It is an issue that some on the left wish had been more forcefully addressed by some of the Democrats in Congress. The second you raise it, you may immediately hear accusations of class warfare, and the only response that I can make to that is we've been having class warfare for quite some time. Historically, the rich have never been willing to give up the benefits that they have, and the more power they have, the more that they want to exercise it. Now, I don't want that to be a blanket statement. There are people born of wealth who do lives of service. Jay Rockefeller is a clear example. Ted Kennedy was a clear example. There are people who come and make a great deal of wealth and determine what they want to do with that wealth is to benefit society. I may disagree with Bill Gates' viewpoint on education, but I do not disagree with the fact that Bill Gates feels he has an obligation to try to help the society that made him so well off. So I don't like universals. I don't like tarring people just because they're in a category. But there is a real problem with increasing inequity in this country, and if we do not address that, if we do not direct address the perception of the increasing inequity and the reality of the shift of power, both financial and political, into richer and richer hands, we run the risk of ceasing to be a functioning democracy.
Of ceasing to be a democracy and something else entirely.
Of ceasing to be a functioning democracy. What I mean by a functioning democracy is where votes actually make a difference. You may still have votes. After all, in the old Soviet Union, 98% of the people voted, but you only had one candidate to choose for. If both parties, candidates in both parties, are chasing after the same financial support, if they're afraid to confront issues because they're afraid of being attacked by large money interests which can run ads against them, and they worry about that, it's logical to worry about that, then will you take on the hard examination that needs to be looked at on the questions that still exist in this country of inequity? Look, we're still not a banana republic. We're a long way from being a banana republic. It's still possible for somebody who starts with very little to become very successful economically or politically. But in politics, perception is reality. The perception right now is that the politicians in Washington have not been taking care of the American people, that they've been taking care of the Wall Street bankers, etc. With that as the perception, the political environment will definitely favor the out party because you blame the party that's in control. The Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And whether or not they have functional control does not matter. End result of all this is you've heard from Obama recently some populist economic rhetoric. He's done some actions in that direction. It looks like the Senate's going to bring up some issues, the House will bring up some other issues, and it may be just enough that the Democrats hold on by narrow margins in both the House and the Senate. If the election were held today, I think it would be too close to call in the House, and the Democrats would wind up with a margin of either 51 or 52 seats at best.
Yeah.
It could still go either way.
Ken, have we gotten to the point where the Democratic Party is Republican light? As much as the conservative Republicans, demonize anybody associated with the Democratic Party, they demonize anybody who's a moderate Republican.
That wound up costing them a House seat that should have stayed Republican on the eastern shore of Maryland when a guy who, like me, was a social studies teacher and a Marine, Wayne Gilchrist, who was a moderate Republican, who representing his district believes in global warming to protect the Chesapeake Bay, was defeated by somebody very far to his right who consistently attacked him as a rhino, Republican in name only, and made the attack so personal that Gilchrist endorsed the Democrat in that race, and that made a difference so that Frank Craddaville won by a very narrow margin. Whether or not he can win and hold the seat again is something else. No, there are quite a few very progressive Democrats. In the House of Representatives, there are more members of the Progressive Caucus than there are of the Blue Dog Caucus, and there are, I think, five who are members of both, if you can believe that. They belong to the Blue Dog Caucus because they believe in fiscal responsibility, that they believe in progressive things like Social Security and health care for all and gay rights in the military. Somebody who's an example of that is Patrick Murphy in the 8th Congressional District in Pennsylvania. So it is not that the entire party is, but sometimes the balance of power, particularly when you have to get to something like 60 votes in the Senate, that gives them more leverage than they actually would have within the party as a whole. How that's going to shake out over the long term, I don't know. Obama is progressive on some things. Obama, in some ways, is a cautious person. Obama, by nature, likes to try to bring people together. But don't ever underestimate Obama's willingness to stick a knife between your ribs and turn it if that's what it takes to get a job done. And what I mean doing that is using his political rhetorical skills to try to shape an election. And I think once this current session for the next 3 weeks ends, you're going to see him out on the road doing that constantly.
Ken Bernstein, he blogs at dailycoast.com as Teacher Ken, public school teacher. Ken, thank you very much for spending some time with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.